right. The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 22-00141, Southwest Airlines Company versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Adam Feinberg on behalf of plaintiff Southwest Airlines Company.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kai Adams for the United States. And with me, James Covey for the United States.
Good morning. Counsel, please be seated. Well, welcome. This is a very interesting case. And counsel are aware that each of you will have 25 minutes for your arguments. You've answered, responded to the questions which were submitted to the court on November 5th. And in the spirit of the holiday season of gifts, yesterday, towards the end of the day, we docketed a few more questions, really stimulated by the answers that you had provided on November 5th. And just to give you a heads up as to some further questions that we had, and no doubt there will be even more questions. So without further ado, we will begin the arguments. And as you know from the letter of November 5th, this is an opportunity for counsel to respond, to rebut, where appropriate, as it were, the answers that have been provided by opposing counsel. As the letter notes, while the argument is dedicated to that kind of rebuttal, each of you within the 25 minutes, if you wanted to give something in the way of an opening statement, that's up to you. That's not required. Again, a very interesting case. To the extent that there are points of agreement in the various filings, that's also helpful to know. Any help that you're able to provide the court as to what the outcome would look like, and again, we've read all the pleadings, would be most helpful. So without further ado, we will begin with Mr. Feinberg. I should also say that, as is my custom, I will provide counsel with an opportunity to file a post-argument submission. That would be due, realizing that Thanksgiving will be coming up. That would be due on Wednesday, December 4th, and not more than 1,500 words. And again, that's an invitation. It's not a directive to file another pleading. Thank you. So, Mr. Feinberg, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I thought I would start with the answer to your question number two from yesterday, because I think that helps to frame the issues, and it addresses a number of the other questions that the parties answered previously, and will also serve as a bit of my introduction to all of this. So your question was, asked us to suppose, as Southwest Airlines, that there was no RTF, no nothing given to the customer who doesn't travel. And the question was simply, would we still prevail? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And this is the most simple path to victory for Southwest, and it doesn't rely really on any facts. It doesn't matter what an RTF is, whether what the refund is, what counts as a refund, all of that is totally irrelevant. The argument here, which we address in the first section of both of our substantive briefs, is that as a statutory and regulatory matter, CBP is simply not permitted to keep a fee if there is no traveling passenger, meaning it hasn't rendered customs services. It's game over at that point. There are no other facts that are relevant other than there is no traveling passenger, which the parties have agreed upon long ago. And so I want to kind of frame that statutory interpretation argument.
So this is an argument where you're not asking the court to take flight with its imagination.
Exactly.
Right.
Well done, Your Honor. I'm going to spend the next few minutes talking about the statute and to some extent about the regulations, but the answer comes from the statute, and you really don't need to look at anything else other than the statutory text to answer this question in Southwest's favor. So let me just frame the dispute a little bit. It's a battle between two subsections of the statute. Subsection A, which is the one that Southwest says governs, is very specific about what the fee applies to. And let me just read the statutory language. It says, the Secretary of the Treasury shall charge and collect the following fees for the provision of customs services in connection with the following. So even that introductory language speaks of the fees being for the provision of customs services. But here's the key part. A5, for the arrival of each passenger aboard a commercial vessel or aircraft from a place outside the United States, other than certain places, $5. It's a very specific fee that is associated, $5, it's now $5.50, but at the during the period of this case, it's $5.50. It goes up for inflation. But it's a single fee, a $5 fee in the statute, for each passenger aboard a commercial aircraft. That's what the fee is. That is the only thing that the government is allowed to keep. That's the end of the story from our perspective. There's much more, but that statutory language in and of itself is dispositive in this case. The government, on the other hand, relies on subsection D, which is the collection procedures. It generally imposes on the government, on an airline, duty to collect, and then sets forth a duty to remit and time frames in which it's supposed to do those things. So specifically, it's supposed to collect at the time of ticketing, and it's supposed to remit within 30 days after the close of the calendar quarter, or 31 days. And if you were to look at that subsection in total isolation, you would say, well, the government's argument is not irrational, that any fee that is actually collected, whether or not the person flies, must be remitted to CBP. But that's only if you look at subsection D in isolation. What about subsection A that we just talked about? This specifically says it's a $5 fee for each passenger arriving on an airplane in the United States. So which of these provisions wins? And if you look at the other provisions of the statute, the answer is extremely clear. It's subsection A. Subsection A defines when CBP is entitled to a fee. So, for example, in subsection E1A, subsection E is about the provision of customs services. This is CBP's duty. It says, the customs services required to be provided to passengers upon arrival in the United States shall be adequately provided in connection with scheduled airline flights at customs service airports when needed, and at no cost, paren, other than the fees imposed under subsection A, end paren, to airlines and airline passengers. So the statute specifically says the only cost, the only amount that CBP gets is the fee imposed by A, not something that was collected, not the amount of fees based on the number of tickets that were sold. Subsection E6 has a very similar provision limiting the amount that CBP is entitled to keep to the fees that are collected under subsection A, not D. And as we've cited repeatedly and the government offers almost no response to, subsection J2, which is on its face just a simple effective date provision, the way it's worded makes unbelievably clear that the imposition of the fee, or rather CBP's entitlement to the fee, is a function of an actual traveling passenger. Here's what it says. Fees may be charged under subsection A only with respect to customs services rendered, so right there's got to be customs services rendered, in regard to arriving passengers using transportation. So there must be an actual arriving passenger who uses transportation for the fee to apply. And then it continues for documents or tickets which are issued after the date, which is 90 days after April 7, 1986. So again, procedurally, the statute ties the timing of certain things to when a ticket was issued. But substantively, it makes very clear that the fee itself applies only for arriving passengers using transportation. And that's the reason why we cited these Supreme Court cases in our reply brief, like King versus Burwell or the Turkey Bulk Bankruptcy case, if I'm pronouncing that even remotely right, that talk about how you should not interpret a statutory provision in isolation. That's exactly what the government is doing here. They say, oh, D, we win. It says you got to collect certain fees and you got to remit what you collect. Game over. But when you look at the broader statute, it's extremely clear that the fee applies only when an actual passenger flies on a plane and arrives in the United States.
Now, the pleadings on both sides have been styled in terms of motions for summary judgment. Are there any factual issues, in your view? You just sort of set out your view of the argument, in terms of the statutory analysis. Is that purely a matter of law? Do facts come into it? Do we have to? Does this court need to make any determinations regarding facts? Are there any disputed facts?
No, Your Honor. And really, there are only one or two facts that are even relevant to this argument, and that is, did the passengers fly? Mm-hmm. The answer to that is no. The government has admitted that. Mm-hmm. And it's a related question, did the government render customs services to those passengers? Again, the answer is no. The government has admitted that. And for example, the fact statement 48, they say no customs services rendered to the passengers at issue. So once you know those facts, that's it. The statute says simply CBP is not entitled to a fee. And I think it's important to understand sort of what the analysis is here. And the American Airlines case, and in particular the Court of Federal Claims decision in the American Airlines case, which obviously was affirmed by the Federal Circuit, speaks of the question, and it literally writes out, this is the question in the case, and it's, does the statute and regulations allow the government to impose liability for the fee in whatever instances are at issue? And that's the same question here. And the statute is pretty clear that the answer here is no, that the fee...
So is it pretty clear or incredibly clear?
It's incredibly
clear to you here.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's incredibly clear when you look at subsection A, subsection E, subsection J2, it's incredibly clear that notwithstanding subsection D, which is just sort of a basic procedural rule for when airlines are supposed to collect and remit in a normal situation. It doesn't speak of this odd situation where a passenger cancels their ticket and wasn't even contemplating that. That those other provisions govern and give a very clear answer to the issue. And there's more to this. The CBP's regulations say the same thing. They also speak of the fee being imposed. This is under subsection G1. They speak of the fees being imposed, again, on a passenger arriving in the United States. And the regulations even go so far as to define a passenger as a natural person for whom transportation is provided. This is in G1, little Roman 5. What's the point of defining passenger to be a natural person who actually travels if that doesn't matter, which is what the government's theory is? They say it doesn't matter if you fly on a plane. Well, all that matters is you bought the ticket. And that's just not how either the statute or the regulations work. There's another problem for the government in its interpretation, and that arises with this example of an infant traveling without a document or ticket. Mm-hmm. And I think the government misunderstands the point here, at least as I read their reply brief. So that section D that they rely on says airlines, D1, it says airlines have to collect these fees. And then D3 says you got to remit those fees, presumably referring to whatever was required to be collected. So the obligation is triggered by D1. And D1 says that the airline has to collect whenever it issues a document or ticket to an individual for transportation by commercial aircraft into the customs territory of the United States. So the collection obligation is only triggered upon issuance of a travel document or ticket, according to the government. If they want to say, well, the substantive fee is governed, when the fee is due, is governed by D. If there's no ticket or travel document, then no fee is due. But the regulations are contrary to that. The regulations specifically say an infant traveling with no ticket or travel document still owes a fee. That just can't be the case if you read section D1 and D3 the way the government wants to read it. You would say, well, the government's theory is that it's the issuance of the ticket that triggers the fee. Well, then an infant without a ticket or travel document would be no fee due. And obviously the regulations say the opposite. And the government responds, oh, well, Southwest doesn't do that. They always issue a travel document. But that's irrelevant. I mean, Southwest might stop doing that. There are other airlines that don't issue tickets or travel documents for an infant, particularly if it's a lap infant. And the government's regulations obviously contemplate that scenario. But the key is that the regulations tie the imposition of the fee to the traveling passenger, in this case an infant. It makes no difference whether there's actually a ticket or travel document. And with that, I want to turn to the first question that you asked yesterday, because it's somewhat related to this. You asked whether services could be provided for an arrival of a passenger sort of before the flight departs in anticipation of passenger arrivals. And I think the answer to that question is, in some conceptual sense, the CBP is allowed to do its prep work or whatever you want to say, but not in anticipation of passenger arrivals. It can only charge fees for actual passenger arrivals. And that's the point of all the statutory and regulatory language that I just discussed. There has to be a natural person for whom transportation is provided under the words of the regulation.
And when you say, conceptually, services in some sort of prep sense might be called into play, what would be an example of that prep?
Well, I can't speak to that specifically, but if the government is going to inspect a particular passenger when they arrive at the airport, it might do whatever it needs to do to make sure that happens, whatever, provide training or uniforms or whatever to the customs officers who are engaged in that activity. But I think there's another issue here. Maybe this is a simpler way of dealing with your question. As a factual matter, the government has conceded the point. They have in no uncertain terms said that no customs services have been rendered for any of the customers at issue. And again, this is in paragraph 48 of their Rule 56.3 statement. And they say as much in their reply brief as well at page 7. So I want to turn to the previous questions. Although a lot of my responses are kind of just going to key off of what I've already said. Mm-hmm. So the first question to the government was about, you know, what business of it is yours, basically, that whether or not customers get a refund. And the answer is none, for all the reasons I've already talked about. The government relies on this GAO report, but that report doesn't do anything for the government's case. In fact, the GAO report talks about the ability to get a refund being triggered by the fact that services are not rendered. This is at page 32 of the GAO report. So even the GAO was thinking, well, it's the fact that there's no traveling passenger and therefore no customs services that gets into this issue of whether or not money can be given back. But again, the main issue is, as a statutory and regulatory matter, the government has no say in anything whatsoever if there's not a traveling passenger, full stop. You asked in later on, as part of question one, about CBP's equitable interests, but equitable interests don't come into play. The question here is there specific statutory authority that allows the government to keep a fee if there's no traveling passenger? And again, the answer is no. And the government cites to a regulation that's for a different user fee, the APHIS user fee, but that provision doesn't apply here. They also cite to a statutory provision for the TSA fee. That provision doesn't apply either. And so why they want to apply these explicit provisions in this case, that where there is no such provision, is a bit of a mystery. And more generally, the reason for those other provisions, even if they existed here, they still wouldn't apply, because the whole point of those provisions is simply to avoid or fall under Section 541D of the Bankruptcy Code. So if an airline goes bankrupt, there's a provision that says, this is 11 U.S.C. 541D, property in which the debtor holds as the commencement of a case only legal title and not equitable interest becomes property of the estate only to the extent of the legal title, but not to the extent of the equitable interest. And so the whole notion of equity is meant to deal with a three-party situation where an airline goes bankrupt and the dispute isn't between the airline and the government. It's between the bankrupt estate or the creditors of the airline who want to grab that same money and the government who says, nope, that's not the airline's money, therefore not part of the bankrupt estate. I, the government, get to keep the money. There's just no issue like that here. So the whole constructive trust issue is just a red herring.
I was going to ask you about when it evokes the notion of a constructive trust, there is often the accompanying thought of, you know, equitable interests. You're about to address that, I think.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. The notion of a constructive trust isn't a substantive legal doctrine. It's a remedy. And so you have to get the right legal answer first. Is anybody entitled to a remedy? That is the government entitled to grab fees from Southwest when a passenger didn't fly? You have to answer that question first before you even get into you even have to address the issue of whether or not a constructive trust would apply. And I think that's the fundamental point the government misses. As a separate matter, the government doesn't have better equitable interests for all the reasons we've already briefed. The government under the statute has no entitlement to these fees. It doesn't even contest that point. It fully admits that if the passenger wants the money, the passenger is entitled to get this money, and it doesn't really belong to CBP. But as between the passenger and Southwest, Southwest got an explicit contract that says, okay, well, passenger, it might have been your entitlement in the first place, but we have a contract that now says I can return it to you in the form of an RTF, and if you don't use it, it's going to expire. And that is a much stronger interest in these funds than the government has. But I think, again, the primary point is you don't even need to get into this issue, because a constructive trust is just irrelevant if you rule for Southwest on the primary statutory interpretation issue that the government's just not entitled to any fees in this situation. I want to just mention briefly in question two, you asked about the assertion that the government's costs don't change when a ticket is canceled. So first off, the government doesn't offer any factual support for any of this. So I don't think any of the government's argument is proper here. In fact, it says in its reply brief that it's, in this whole case, it's relying only on its Rule 56.3 statement, and that statement doesn't address any of these facts. But second of all, the government concedes in its response that CBP's projections are based on an expected number of travelers net of, quote, a certain number of cancellations per ticket sold. So the government has already baked this notion of cancellations into its estimates. And then finally, the most important point, again, is the thing I've said 100 times by now, which is the government simply is never entitled to a fee if a passenger doesn't travel. So,
By the way, what is your do you have a home run case for that proposition?
For which proposition?
That the government is not entitled to a fee if the passenger has not traveled.
Well, I would say that we have a home run. Well, we have, maybe the best way to put it is we have four singles that score the run, but not all in the same case. Because if you look at the statutory interpretation cases, they very plainly focus on that this is the proper way to interpret a statute. And then I think what maybe is in and of itself a home run is the statutory language itself. It's not a case, obviously, but in our view, the statutory language is clear, and that's just the end of the story. So I want to turn in just in my remaining time to your question three to the government, but also address more generally the notion of a refund, because we have a whole separate argument. So even if you reject our statutory interpretation and say, no, no, the government's right, subsection D governs, and any time you collect a fee, it has to be remitted, Southwest still wins because it gave value back to the passenger in the form of the RTF. And there are really kind of two sub-arguments there. It gave value back to the passenger, and that is sufficient. And second, whatever you want to say about it, that an RTF is in fact a refund. And all of the government's argument sort of is a mistake of timing. They look to what happened at the end of the day, but the question is, what happened when you actually, the Southwest, issued the RTF? Was it a thing of value at that time? And the answer is plainly yes. The government admits that an RTF is worth something. It's just worth less than the face value. There's no dispute about that, but it's plainly valuable enough to constitute a return of the $5.50. And we laid this out in our brief on page 28 in our opening brief, and if you look at ECF number 14-1 at pages 69 and 70, there's an email that Southwest sends to the customers, and it goes through all of the actual numbers for a particular ticket. So the airfare was $966, and then there are a bunch of fees, including the $5.50 fee. So the total is $1,058. And so the RTF was $1,058. Is that RTF worth at least $5.50? I sure would take that deal any day of the week. And that's really what the issue is here. An RTF might be worth somewhat less than its face value, but it's certainly a return of way more than the fee that's at issue.
So the The red light is flashing, but I will give you, how many more minutes do you need? Two?
Two, I think.
And, of course, we'll add that on to the government's time as well.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Your Honor. And, by the way, that same email specifically says that we, Southwest, are, this money has been refunded to the customers in the form of an RTF. And, of course, there are all the other facts, what Southwest accounting records say, even what a CDP auditor said, what the flying public seems to say. Everybody seems to agree that as a factual matter, an RTF is, in fact, a refund.
Is there a disagreement?
Well, the government obviously does disagree with that.
Right, so when you say everybody...
Well, other than the government in this case, I should say.
Yeah.
But the case law is also overwhelmingly on Southwest's side. So we cited the 11th Circuit decision in Caver, and then a district court decision, which is very explicit on exactly the issue here in Davis, that specifically says that everybody understands that a refund can be in the form of, for example, a store credit, and that that's just the generally commonly understood definition of credit. There's an IRS revenue ruling dealing specifically with airline tickets that says credits, the return of money in the form of credit is just as good as cash, and the same rules as cash apply. So the law is overwhelming that an RTF, whether or not it's labeled a refund, and you don't really need to get it at that question, it's certainly enough of a return of value that you would say the fee has been uncollected under subsection D, if you even want to go down that road. And the government says that their test in question 3B is, has value been gained by the customer? But no more value is gained with an uncashed check than an unused RTF. So they really haven't answered the question there. Thank you, Your Honor, unless you have anything else for me.
We will have something else for you, but we'll hear from the government now. I note that you didn't have a chance. I mean, you had a chance in a sense, but the time ran out before you could address questions, 4 through 6, as provided by the government. So I will give the parties 3 or 4 minutes for rebuttal each. After the government concludes its initial argument.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court? I really appreciate plaintiff's clarity with respect to the issue of whether the customer is entitled to any refund here. And as Mr. Feinberg laid out, Southwest believes that it is not required to return anything of value to its customer who may cancel the ticket. And so in the government's view, this case is about an unjustified taking. Southwest is standing, the commercial airlines and Southwest here specifically, is standing in the shoes of the government when it collects a fee. It is required by the statute, 19 U.S.C. 58C, to collect a fee. And Southwest points to 58C subsection A, which is the schedule of fees, which lays out the schedule of fees, including the $5, now $5.50 at this time, now it's higher. It's a long statute. It has many different provisions, but I think the court should read that as a whole, including subsection A, which Southwest points to, which covers the schedule of fees, as well as subsection D, which covers the collection of fees, and really puts the airline in the position of the collector of the fee. And at the time that the airline collects the fee, the obligation to remit the fee to the government attaches. The airline here is truly standing in the shoes of the government for collecting the fee. It is the government's fee. And as Mr. Feinberg laid out, by statute, under subsection D, the fee must be separately identified on the ticket or the travel document. So it is not part of Southwest's airfare. And I think that's the crucial point here. This is a separate fee. It is not part of the airline's airfare. And the airline cannot contract away that government fee in its contract of carriage with its customer. It's not subject to that. They can do that with their airfare, but they can't do that with the government's fee, which they've collected in the government's name. So at the time the airline collects the fee, the obligation to remit it attaches under subsection 58C, subsection D. And the Southwest, and it's, as Mr. Feinberg did this morning by saying that, you know, there's nothing that Southwest needs to return to its customers who don't fly, it has also made very clear that the fee in Southwest's view ceases to exist when the customer cancels the ticket. When the customer cancels their travel plan, Southwest states in its responses to the court's questions, it says that the fees cease to exist when the ticket was canceled. That Southwest cannot make the government's fee cease to exist under its contract of carriage with its customer. The fee exists. It can't be written out of existence just because Southwest decides that. And so here the fee continues to exist, because the fee exists, it needs to be remitted to the government unless, pursuant to the regulations, Southwest is entitled under the regulations to take an adjustment on its next quarterly payment to the government because a fee is no longer collected. In other words, the customer canceled the ticket, got a refund, and then the fee is uncollected for the purposes of making that adjustment in the next quarterly payment. So in this case, there are going to a few of the points you asked Mr. Feinberg this morning. The government agrees with Southwest that there are essentially no facts in dispute here, and that was why the parties worked together to file a stipulation of statement of facts that they agreed upon, and to cut off a lot of fact discovery in this case, because it is a legal question under the statute. The government's view, as I've stated, is that the airline stands in the shoes of the government, collects the fee. At that point, the obligation to remit the fee attaches. And here, Southwest, for every ticket at issue in this case, Southwest ended up pocketing that fee as profit. Now, in its responses to the court's question, Southwest denies that it has profited from these fees. And that's because, in Southwest's view, the fee ceased to exist. The fees did not cease to exist, Your Honor. There's no place in the statute that says that the fee ceases to exist. There's no statutory support for that. In addition, I wanted to point the court to the American Airlines case, which we cited in our briefing from the Federal Circuit, that likewise agrees that it's a different fee at issue in that case, but agrees that the obligation to remit the fee attaches with collection. And so in that case, when the airlines did not collect the fee, there was no obligation to remit it. Even if the government ended up performing the inspection in that case, because the airlines had not collected the fee, there was no obligation for them to remit it. And so in this case, where the airline does collect the fee, there is an obligation that attaches to remit it. And Southwest is simply, by writing the fee out of existence, subject to its contract of carriage with its customers, it is converting the government's money into its own. And Southwest can't do that. As I've stated, Southwest is simply collecting the fee in the shoes of the government, okay, and standing in the shoes of the government. Under color of law, it is collecting that fee, and it must remit that to the government. So, as Mr. Feinberg said, you know, it doesn't matter whether they give their customer anything of value, whether it's a voucher or nothing whatsoever. They can't convert the fee to their own money.
What is your home run case for that proposition?
Again, the government points the court to the overall statute of 58C, including subsection A and D, and the American Airlines case in the Federal Circuit, which discusses a related fee and states that the obligation to remit that fee to the government is only attached if the airline actually collected the fee. And here the airline collected the fee, but is a different fee, but is refusing to remit that fee.
So your view is that the court need not go beyond looking at the face of the statute to decide this issue?
I think the face of the statute, Your Honor, the American Airlines case, are what the government relies upon. And, you know, the government, as we may talk about further today, has tried to be reasonable in this case as well with Southwest, and has tried to recognize that a travel voucher that Southwest provides to its customers can provide value to the customer and can constitute a refund if the customer actually uses it and receives some value from it. In every case, every ticket at issue in this case, the customer received no value whatsoever from the voucher. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there was no money provided back, no value provided back to the customer, and definitely no money. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's not the fee remains collected such that it must be remitted to the government pursuant to the statute. And the regulations which allow for an adjustment to be made don't come into play here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, are you? I'm sorry.
I'm happy to talk about other responses, but this was, I understood, was like more of an opening. I'm happy to address the court's other questions.
Right. Well, it would be helpful if you could respond to the answers as provided by Southwest.
Yes, of course, Your Honor.
In the form of, you know, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. With respect to the court's question one to Southwest, whether Southwest's travel vouchers, which Southwest refers to as residual travel funds or RTFs, are a refund, whether that's a question of fact or law. We agree that the overall issue here, Your Honor, as I've stated, is a question of law. I think the only, because it's a question of law, we need to go back to the statute to answer this question. The first statutory issue is whether the fee was collected under 58C subsection D. Here, Southwest collected the fee, and therefore, in the government's view, it is required to remit it under 58C subsection D, which says that D1A talks about collect from the individual the fee charged, subsection B, which also says it must separately identify that fee as not part of its airfare, but as a government fee that is being collected in the government's name. And then 58C subsection D3 says that the person who collects the fees under paragraphs 1 or 2 shall remit those fees to the Secretary of the Treasury at any time before the date that is 31 days after the close of the calendar quarter in which the fees are collected. And so that's the obligation to remit the fees that are collected. And that's how the Federal Circuit viewed this issue in a related fee matter in the American Airlines case, and said that basically where the airline didn't collect the fee, it was not required to remit it, even if an inspection occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So in our view, the correct statutory analysis is simply whether the fee was collected, and if so, Southwest cannot, through its possession of that fee, convert that fee into its own money. It remains the government's fee and cannot be written out of existence. It has not ceased to exist. Whether the RTF itself is a refund, again, the word refund doesn't appear in the statute or the regulation. Whether it constitutes a return of value to the customer in such a way that the airline is entitled to take a credit on a future remittance to the government is, I think, somewhat of a mixed question of fact and law here. And where the customer, as is the case for all the tickets at issue here, received no value whatsoever, I don't see how the how it can be, how Southwest can claim that there's been a refund. There's been nothing of value transferred back to the customer. And Mr. Feinberg pointed to examples of where people may find an RTS to be valuable, and that's certainly the case. There may be some customers who find that to be valuable. You can also imagine a customer who does not intend to fly within the next year and would just like their government fee refunded, because a voucher, if I don't intend to fly within the time period of the RTS, has no value to me. I'm not going to be able to use that. So in that case, I may just want a refund of my fee. And here I can't get that. I can't, from Southwest customers can't get the refund of their fee. They can get a voucher, which may or may not have any value to them. And clearly, all of these cases here where the RTS expired unused entirely, those were cases in which the passengers received no value from those so-called refunds. With respect to question number two, Your Honor, what the government, whether additional deference or respect would be due to the letter, the government's, CBP's letters before the Loper-Bright decision. Here again, Your Honor, the government, the agency's two letters of 2010 to the airline industry should be viewed as a type of informed compliance document. You know, CBP puts out a lot of information to importers and other bodies that it regulates, and this was an informative letter that said how CBP views these types of situations. I think these were new things that were starting to happen as airlines were issuing these types of vouchers and had different flexible cancellation policies. And so it simply states the agency's position on how airlines should handle collection and remittance of the fee in the face of these types of travel vouchers. The government had never sought deference to that letter, to those letters, and the court, this is a 1581A case, and as the court knows, it's a de novo review by the court, and the issue here is not the agency's letters, other than that those are advisory to the airline industry. I don't have much to say about the Kauke versus Southwest. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. We agree that that doesn't really speak to the issue here. I think the important case law here that we point to is the American Airlines case, which talks about remittance of fees that are collected. With respect to question number four, Your Honor, I think this is question number four to Southwest. The government's argument that Southwest does not even attempt to justify its position that it is entitled to keep the customs inspection fee pursuant to the statute. There's no support that Southwest can cite for that proposition, that it isn't somehow entitled to the fee when there's any justification for it to keep that fee when it is collected in the government's name.
Southwest goes on in its response to say the proper focus is not on whether the statute entitles Southwest to keep the fee. Instead, the question is whether the statute authorizes CBP to keep the fee when the ticket is canceled. The customer never travels on a plane, and CBP renders no custom service. And your response?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no customer travels for all the tickets at issue in this case. No inspection services were rendered by the government. But this is not Southwest's money. The money was collected in the government's name, and possession does not make, possession is not 9/10 of the law, or should not be in this case. Just because Southwest collects it and holds it does not entitle it to that money. And it cannot write that money out of existence. The fee, as Southwest says, ceases to exist when the customer cancels a ticket, and there's no support for that in the statute.
I mean, the Southwest goes on in its response, as you know, Southwest's entitlement to the funds derives from its customers' rights to those funds and their assignment of those rights to Southwest. Notably, the government concedes that the customers are entitled to the funds over CBP.
I think this goes to what Your Honor, I think, is asking Mr. Feinberg about the equitable argument. So in addition to the statutory argument, the government makes an equitable argument here, that the equities are such that Southwest has no equitable right to this money. The customer has an equitable right to this money. And when Southwest is not returning that money to the customer, then it is the government's money. That's an equitable argument, not a statutory argument here. I think Southwest has no equitable right to this argument, to this fund, to these funds, and Southwest cannot turn the customer's equitable right to a refund into something that can be governed by their contract of carriage with their customer. And so that is an equitable issue that I think the court may weigh in deciding who is ultimately entitled to these funds. And it's an interesting question, Your Honor, as to whether the customer could sue the government for a refund of the fee in a case where they haven't received any value from Southwest. And that would be an interesting question because the government might be on the hook for that fee even if Southwest didn't return it to them. I think Southwest customers cannot assign, Southwest is making it sound like its customers have assigned their right to a refund to Southwest, and they can't do that. The customers can't assign their right to a government fee to a private organization, to an airline. So the Southwest contract is contracted carriage can't provide.
And your best case for that proposition?
Again, I would point to the language of the statute.
When you say that Southwest cannot assign,
I don't have a case site for that, Your Honor. I don't. Not one more. I think here. The statute could have been written differently. It's written, if we have what we have. But the statute could have required the government to collect the fee directly, the agency to collect the fees directly from the customer. In that case, we wouldn't have this issue, right? The government would have the fee and then would return it back to the passenger if they didn't fly and weren't inspected. What we have here is the airline deciding that it can take that fee that it collects in the government's name and somehow use it as a private negotiating tool in its contract with its customer. And I don't think there's any support for that proposition in the statute. Again, a related question number five, the government asserts that Southwest has profited from its collection of fees under color of law. Of what relevance to the court's consideration of this assertion, if any, is that when an RTF, the voucher, expires, Southwest credits the funds as revenue. Again, in our view, Your Honor, it's pretty clear that Southwest takes the government's money here, turns it into a private, writes it out of existence, and returns it, as Mr. Feinberg said, the ticket lays out the airfare price, the government's inspection fee, and then the total amount that the customer has paid in U.S. dollars. And then when the customer cancels the ticket, they give that total amount back to the customer in a voucher, ignoring the government's fee or including the amount of the government's fee in that voucher that they've collected. But that is not their money to negotiate with or to provide in the form of a voucher. And there's no mention of that in the regulations or in the statute that that Southwest has a private right to control what happens to the government's fee. Once again, I'd point the court to the regulations, 19 CFR 24.22G5, which talks about overpayments. It talks about quarterly payments and statement procedures, and the payment to CBP of the fees required to be collected under paragraph G1 of this section must be made no later than 31 days after the close of the calendar quarter in which the fees were required to be collected from the passenger. Payment of the fees must be made to the party required to collect the fee under this section, and must be made in accordance with the procedures and payment methods set forth in the paragraph. Overpayments and underpayments may be accounted for by an explanation with and adjustment of the next due quarterly payment to CBP. So the regulations permit the airline to take to make an adjustment on their next quarterly payment for an overpayment or an underpayment, provided with an explanation. Here, there is no overpayment for which Southwest is entitled to take a credit from the government. And as I mentioned, the government has tried to take a reasonable view here, which is that if the passenger received some value from that RTF, which they did in many of the cases that are not at issue in this case, many of the tickets issued that were examined in the audit, then those tickets were credited as being refunded, and then as if an overpayment was made and Southwest was entitled to take credit on the future payment when Southwest customer received any value whatsoever. Mm-hmm. For all the tickets at issue here, the customer received no value.
Mm-hmm.
Turning to question number six, the court's question here asked about a fair notice doctrine and whether an agency is depriving a party of property by imposing a civil or criminal liability. Southwest, in the government's view, is not being deprived of anything here. It's Southwest that is depriving the government of the inspection fees that it collects, it is legally required to collect and remit. And so that the only taking here was that of the government's fee, which Southwest wrote out of existence.
So in your view, the fair notice doctrine does not apply?
No, Your Honor. The notice that was provided here is the statute and the regulation. That's the requirement. And so that sets out the law. There's no taking of Southwest's money here. It was not and will never be Southwest's money. It is a government fee that Southwest collects. Thank you.
Right, we still have some more time on the clock. I just wanted to ask you to respond to question seven.
Okay.
As presented to Southwest, and also the questions that we submitted last.
Yes, John.
Yesterday afternoon.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Thank you. So with respect to question number seven, that was, have any other courts ruled on Southwest challenges to the other fees at issue in CBP's 2017 audit? If so, how might those rulings bear on this case? We're not aware of any other cases that deal with this.
Okay.
Which I think was Southwest's response as well. And with respect to the court's questions from yesterday, questions for the government. The first question of the government in yesterday's filing, ECF number 60, states that 19 U.S.C. 58C permits CBP's inquiry into whether customers who do not fly receive a refund. But aside from the general audit provision, you cite 19 U.S.C. 1509, what specific statutory authority does CBP have to regulate the provision of compensation that airlines give to their non-flying customers under a private contract of carriage? And this also relates to Southwest's point that to the extent any federal agency could attempt to regulate its contracts of carriage with its customers, that would be the Department of Transportation. Our response to that is straightforward, Your Honor. The government has no interest here in regulating Southwest's contracts of carriage with its customers. The agency is not purporting to do that. The agency is just seeking that the contract of carriage does not write the government's fee out of existence, which it has no authority to do. Southwest is required to follow the law, which is 19 U.S.C. 58C, mm-hmm. And the regulations that were promulgated pursuant to that statute. And the statute actually provides that CDC has the authority under 19 U.S.C. 58C, subsection G, provides that the agency can promulgate regulations and enforce those regulations subject to the statute, which is what CDC did here in the applicable regulations that talk about overpayments and underpayments and adjustments for that. The statute is CDC is not interested in inquiring whether Southwest customers receive a refund. CDC is interested in Southwest collecting the fees as it did, remitting those fees to the government, and then if those fees are uncollected for the purpose of the statute because the customer has canceled their ticket and received their money back, the government's money back, then the Southwest is entitled to take credit for that. It is simply standing in the shoes of the government here. And so if the government had collected that fee and the passenger canceled their ticket and the government returned that fee to the customer, to the passenger, the fee is uncollected. And therefore, Southwest is no longer on the hook for remitting that fee to the government.
So, and I know that you're a bit over time here. With respect to question two, which focuses on the uncollected question,
yes.
Is there anything more that you want to say? As you've just been referencing the uncollected concept.
Right.
This is from yesterday's question.
I think that I basically said that the crux of the holding of the American Airlines case is that once the fee is collected, it must be remitted. If the fee is not collected, even if the government performs inspection, the airlines are not on the hook for that fee. And so in this case, whatever value an RTF may have to the customer depends on that customer. And the government has just tried to take a reasonable view here that if the passenger received value, then the government has tried to credit that as an uncollection of the fee. Right, so if the passenger ended up receiving value from this voucher that Southwest created, the agency is regulating many different or supervising many different airlines here, and they all have different policies and different contracts of carriage and different ways they handle either travel vouchers or refunds or non-refunds. And I think one interesting point here is Southwest, if you buy an actual refundable ticket from Southwest, they will give you a refund of the government's fee, an actual cash refund. But if you buy a non-refundable ticket from Southwest, then you get the voucher. It can't be that the government's fee can be controlled in this manner by Southwest's private agreement with its client. The government's fee doesn't change regardless of the contract of carriage, right? Regardless of whether the passenger bought a refundable ticket or a non-refundable ticket from Southwest, does not change anything under the statute or the regulation as to Southwest's obligation to collect that fee and to remit it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
As noted, I will provide counsel with sort of a final round here. We appreciate everybody having come to the courthouse, and so we're all here. So Mr. Feinberg, we'll give you 4 minutes.
Appreciate the extra time, Your Honor. So picking up with the questions, the previous set of questions, question number four that you asked of the government was, what would it matter if the CBP letter was never issued? And the government says it makes no difference. This is a huge, huge problem for the government because on the one hand, it's agreed that it's not entitled to any sort of deference or respect for the letter. But on the other hand, that's the only government document that even uses the word refund. It doesn't define what refund means, but it's the only document that says that. And if that letter doesn't mean anything, you're kind of left in the world of, well, where do all these rules come from? They're just completely made up out of whole cloth. Mr. Eden mentioned the notion of uncollection of a fee. Where did that come from? The statute doesn't talk about uncollection of a fee, and your question to the government from yesterday gets at this issue too. And this is all just made up by the government. And I keep going back to the main point I started with in the opening, which is the statute addresses all of this. It says if there's no traveling passenger, the government doesn't get a fee, end of story. It doesn't matter whether the fee is collected and then uncollected or collected but then not uncollected. There's just nothing in the statute about notions along those lines, and I think the court should avoid going down that route.
Mm-hmm. What about the concept that Southwest, in a way, is standing in the shoes of the government?
Well, so that is right. The Southwest is a collection agent to some extent for the government. But once the fee disappears, or the government's entitlement to the fee disappears because there's no traveling passenger, the government's out of the picture. It's only a private relationship between Southwest and the customer at that point. And I want to address, in connection with that, the American Airlines case, because that case definitely doesn't support the government the way the government thinks it does, because it deals with a situation where the airline as the collector didn't collect the fee. It doesn't say the fees weren't owed, so theoretically the government could have gone after the passengers and say, hey, you refused to pay your fees. So the fees are still owed under the statute. It's just that the government can't hold the airline liable for them if it doesn't collect. So when is an airline, as just the collector of the fee, liable to the government? Two things have to be true. Number one, there has to be an actual imposition of the fee under subsection A. That is to say, there must be an actual traveling passenger. Without that, the government has zero entitlement to a fee ever. And number two, the airline has to have actually collected the fee, because if it didn't do that, there's no secondary liability provision. The government's remedy is to go after the passenger if it wants to do that. In government question five, you asked about the ascertainable certainty standard, and we think the fair notice doctrine does apply. But by the way, I don't think you need to get into this issue. This issue is only relevant if you reject all of Southwest's arguments in its motion. We didn't raise this in our motion, but the fair notice doctrine is raised in the complaint. And so if you get to the issue of granting the government summary judgment motion, you will obviously have to look at the fair notice doctrine. But we think it does apply, and we detailed a lot of the case law on this in response to question six that you asked us. But there is property that's being taken here from Southwest, namely its contractual right to the funds at issue. The government saying, you have this property, and we're ripping it out of your hands, despite the fact that you do have a valid contract governed by the Department of Transportation with your customer. On question six that you asked to the government, we agree that there's no jurisdictional defect here. And then on the other questions, I just wanted to return briefly to the American Airlines case, because as I said, that case deals with a situation where a fee should have been collected but wasn't. And it just doesn't speak at all to this situation, which is, well, is a fee owed in the first place? But there's lots of language in that case that talks about when the fee is actually imposed. And it talks about the fee is imposed when a passenger actually travels and arrives in the United States. Well, that part of the case is important too. And as I said, these two requirements have to be true in order for an airline to be liable. There has to be a traveling passenger that triggers the fee, and the airline has to have collected. And I see I'm over time, although I had a couple other points.
Well, why don't you finish up, and I'll add a couple more minutes if the government wishes to take advantage of that as well.
Okay. Yeah. So the other points just relate to, is an RTF a refund or at least a sufficient return of value? And again, I don't think you need to get there, because I think we just win no matter what an RTF is, or even if there's no RTF at all. I mean, the government says, well, what about this passenger who doesn't want to travel in the next year? there's still value in the RTF, and the Dowding case that we cite says exactly that. It might be less than the face value of the voucher, but Dowding was involved a woman who bought an airline ticket to go on a cruise, and then COVID hit. And she missed the cruise and now had a voucher on Frontier that was good for only 90 days in the height of COVID. Talk about a passenger who is never going to use that credit, but the court still says it's not zero. There's still some value there. And I think the government's mistake is trying to look at each personal situation of the customer and say, well, it's worth a lot to that person. It's worth a little to this person. This person used it. This person didn't. That's all wrong. The issue is, on the day the RTF was issued, was it a thing of value? And it certainly was. At least it was worth $5.50. And consider this hypothetical. The government says, oh, well, the fee never ceases to exist. They criticize Southwest's argument. But how could a fee ever cease to exist? Why is it that a refund will make the fee cease to exist? There's no explanation anywhere for how that might be the case. Consider the fact that you can use an RTF for a non-international ticket to which this customs fee doesn't apply, and so the customer is using it on an unrelated ticket. There's no fee ever paid to the government, but that's good enough for the government, and obviously there, they must think the fee exists. Why is that? And then finally, consider a hypothetical where instead of doing what Southwest does, it gives the customer a cash refund and then immediately imposes a penalty. This is exactly what happened in the United Airlines case. And so the government would say, well, if you give them a cash refund, that undoes the fee. You're good. You get to, you know, we're not going to take the money from you, Southwest. But at that point, if we just call it something else, if we just say, well, passenger, you're being penalized, now you got to give the money back to us, that in the government's world would be okay. That just makes no sense. The commercial relationship between the passenger and Southwest has nothing to do with the airline's liability to the government for the fee. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eddy?
Thank you. I wanted to make two very quick points, Your Honor. One is that in the government's view, as I've stated, the obligation to remit the fee attaches the time of collection. Southwest, as a second requirement, says that the obligation to remit is only attached if there's a collection of the fee under American Airlines and an inspection occurs. And so I just wanted to raise the point that an inspection doesn't always occur, and the government still entitles the fee. And an easy example of that is if the passenger just doesn't show up for their flight. They don't cancel their ticket. They don't get a voucher. They've paid the fee when they bought the ticket, and then they don't show up. No passenger flies. No passenger is inspected in that case. And in that example, the Southwest thinks that it's entitled to take a credit and make an adjustment on a future payment just because the passenger didn't show up. The government's fee was collected, and that's when the obligation to remit it attached, even if no inspection occurred. And the second point is related to the case that Mr. Feinberg just brought up, which is United Airlines. And in that case, right, there were two separate transactions that the court found there. One was a refund of the government's fee, and the second was a private contractual penalty that the airline had with its customer. And that is a separate matter. And so that's not the case that we have here. Those facts aren't present here. And there's no dispute that there is not first a monetary refund and then some sort of contractual penalty between the airline and its customer, for example, for the privilege of getting a voucher.
Thank you, Mr. Eddin.
Thank you.
So that concludes the arguments. I want to note again that counsel will have an opportunity to file a post-argument submission of not more than 1,500 words. I do want to clarify that this would be due on December 4th by noon. again, I'm trying to build in some time for Thanksgiving and, travel for those observances. So I'd like to thank counsel for the outstanding arguments. Really, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you, Mr. Feinberg, Mr. Eden, Mr. Cohey. I see Ms. Lee is observing the argument. Wish you all good holidays, safe travels by plane, train, or automobile, and until the next time we find each other in the same place. So thank you very, very much.
All rise. Court stands adjourned.